You may wonder why I have been asked to talk about the Great Depression. After all, the Great Depression was an economic phenomenon way back, some 50 years ago. Why such an old topic here? Well, the discussion of the Great Depression is of utmost importance even today. And why? Because radical government intervention had its beginning at that time. All the modern economic policies, modern economic institutions had their beginning during the Great Depression, or the justification, the intellectual justification is the Great Depression. When you look at our textbooks today, look at any economic college textbook, now you will find that they all, without exception, are pointing at the Great Depression at the time when the free economy has failed, and when government had to step in to rescue economic life and rescue the American people from utter despair and unemployment and depression. Every textbook, whether it's a conservative textbook or a liberal textbook, they all make the point that the free economy failed, that FDR, President Roosevelt, had to step in, the government had to embark upon massive spending, that it had to introduce social security, unemployment compensation, because the free economy failed. They all say this. And modern interventionism of any form points at the Great Depression. No matter what I'm researching in modern textbooks, they all point at the Great Depression as an evidence, proof that freedom failed, that this program is needed, that program is needed, you know, whatever. The justification usually is the Great Depression. When you debate someone about radical interventionism, invariably they will point up, they will come to the assertion that, after all, look at the Great Depression, look at the unemployment in the past, look at the misery in the past, look at freedom in the past, it failed. Debate anyone, that's going to be an answer. There's almost uniformity of belief and opinion that freedom failed in the past, and therefore the Great Depression ushered in a new age, a new system, and the new system, the rationale of the new system is the Great Depression. Now, although there have been a few writers who have been writing about the Great Depression, mostly the writers of our school of thought, but I don't think we have made much of a dent there. The American public opinion still believes that the Great Depression was a failure of freedom and the government had, politicians had to step in. Here today, I would like to refute this. I would like to demonstrate that freedom has not failed, that politics has failed, that the Great Depression was the inevitable outcome, the result of disastrous economic policies. And if we repeat these economic policies again, then there is going to be another depression. If we repeat the errors of the past, then the consequences have to be the same. The effects, the disaster has to be the same again. Let's look at it. And, you know, the Great Depression was the deepest and longest depression in American history. Surely there had been other depressions before. There had been in 1921, 1922. There had been a kind of a recession in 1907 to 1908. There had been a depression 1893 to 1897, 1873 to 1878. There had been a depression 1857 to 1860, 1837 to 1843, and one 1819 to, the first one 1819 to 1820. There had been depressions before, and why? All for the same reason. Our explanation of depressions is when government or financial institutions expand money, we call this fiduciary credit expansion, print money, expand money, falsify the financial markets, that brings about an economic boom. An economic boom is a kind of financial fever that leads to many mistakes, and when finally the fever breaks, then there has to be a readjustment, And that's the recession time. That's the depression time. In our view, the depression time is the healing time, the adjustment time. The preceding economic boom is the time when the harm is done. When the money is injected, then the injection of new money by the financial system, whether that's a central bank or whatever it may be, injecting additional funds, new funds, creating funds, then this injection of newly printed or created funds lowers interest rates, falsifies interest rates. Then businessmen who are watching the lower interest rates, they believe that at the lower interest rates, more capital is available. They embark upon expansion, modernization, you know, and although there are no actual savings, it's all false, it's falsification. The interest rates are false interest rates, leading to a falsely induced feverish activity at the lower interest rates, and sooner or later then they discover, you know, that there are no funds, and therefore sooner or later then the interest rates will shoot up again, and then the recession will set in. Now at times that becomes visible through soaring costs. When we have feverish economic activity that's falsely induced through this expansion of money, then there's feverish activity. The cost of production tend to rise. Machines, tools, dyes, and equipment and labor tends to rise in cost. The costs rise until they are no longer until business is no longer profitable. At that point, then the reversal begins. At first one company, then one industry after the other will have to curtail because the costs have risen beyond profitability and therefore beginning to inflict losses on business. And at that time, then the curtailment, the recession begins, and the recession continues until the costs have been adjusted, until business becomes profitable again. And then business resumes and the recession or the depression is over. This has happened many times before. In every case where government had expanded money and credit, I mentioned the depression of 1920-1921, the post-World War I depression. There was rampant inflation, easy money to finance the war effort, and therefore there was easy money, wartime inflation, and then the recession, the inevitable recession, then came in 1920-1921. In 1893, what happened at that time? There had been, from 1878 on until 93, there had been an expansion of money based on silver. There had been silver legislation, the Bland-Allison Act of 1878, forcing the Treasury to mint silver coins and issue silver certificates. There was a massive expansion of silver certificates. The Congress tried to push silver into circulation and silver certificates. The inflation was the silver legislation. That was the Bland-Allison Act of 1878. Then 1890, the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, even faster printing of silver certificates and issue of silver money, thus bringing about then a feverish activity, finally a crisis. Gold was leaving the country by 1893. Now there was a money crisis. As a matter of fact, the gold supply in the United States had dropped. Because of this easy money, silver money, the gold supply had dropped to some $33 million worth of gold, at which time even the many people urged the president, Grover Cleveland, to suspend payments, to default, so to speak, but he refused to do so. As a matter of fact, he called the Congress into a special session and insisted that the silver legislation be repealed. And in December of 1893, finally the inflation legislation was repealed. But at that time, then the inflation broke. The the fever broke, the recession, the readjustment set in, there was a depression from 1893 to 1897. Or when you look at the depression of 1873 to 1878, is the post-Civil War depression. During the Civil War was rampant inflation, the issue of greenbacks. The Lincoln administration had financed the war, depending heavily on the issue of legal tender money, just printing money, greenbacks. And finally, and that continued for a while, then easy money after the Civil War, through the new national banking system also created to finance the war and issue paper money. And finally it came to the readjustment of the depression of 1873 to 1878. Or if you look at the depression of 1837 to 1843, was a time after the Second Bank of the United States had come into existence and finally was liquidated then in 1836. Was a big bank, Federal Bank had existed, the Second Bank of the United States had expanded credit, and finally then it had to contract and go out of business. President Jackson refused to issue a new fought against it, and so it had to withdraw, it had to liquidate. And if you liquidate a big central bank, withdrawing all the cash and so on, that's a kind of deflation. And once again, then there was a depression from 1837 to 1843. Or even when you look at the first depression in American history, 1819, that was precisely 3 years after this big central bank had started, had printed lots of money, had printed and expanded from 1816, had come into existence in 1816, then went on a spending binge. By 1819, it was in trouble, have overexpanded, it had to contract, and there was the first depression in American history. My point is that all these trade cycles, the trade cycle are induced by the expansion of money, creation of money by the monetary authorities, whether that's the central bank or the treasury printing money, greenbacks or whatever it may be. Now, when you falsify the economy, falsify the interest rates, then that leads to maladjustment, malinvestments. And these malinvestments sooner or later will have to be corrected because they have no justification in real life. Now, and therefore, sooner or later, there's going to be a readjustment, which is a recession. This is actually what happened in 1929. However, when I look at the Great Depression, that's the depression from 1929 to 1941, to Pearl Harbor, because on the day of Pearl Harbor, there were still 9.5 million unemployed, so they never pulled out of the depression until World War II, until there was a draft and some 12.5 million men were drafted that took care of the unemployment in 1942 and 1943. But when in the case of the Great Depression, it's a very long one, much longer than all the others and deeper than all the others. A simple financial explanation is not enough. Please note, when I mentioned the other depressions in American history, there was a easy money, the expansion of money, the printing of money first, and then for 3-4 years thereafter, there was a depression. It may take 3-4 years of readjustment after the financial structure really has been disarranged, and there's fever, there's maladjustment, bad investments are being made on account of false interest rates. Now, it takes about 3 or 4 years, but in the case of the Great Depression, we are talking about 1929 to 1941. We are talking about 12 years of Great Depression. How's that? Well, actually, in this case, when I look at the Great Depression, it's not just one set of causes. I see four. I see four depressions rolled into one. The first one being financial, the one I explained. And there, in 1929, when you see a crash, you have to search for the easy money, the boom first. There cannot be a boom, there cannot be a bust, there cannot be a depression without the preceding economic boom. As a matter of fact, in my classes at the college, frequently, no, this is an examination question for seniors. Now, I may say, please explain the depression or the recession of 1981-82. The students who begin with 1981-82 and describe the depression, they may have to do it again next year. They may have to come back, you know. But the proper explanation is, to explain a depression, you have to search for the preceding economic boom. You have to write and explain 1976, 77, 78, the fever of easy money. You have to talk about 20% inflation, easy money expansion, you know, the dollar crisis, and then the depression. You have to explain a depression, you have to search for the preceding economic boom. There cannot be a depression, there cannot be a bust, there cannot be a crash without the preceding economic boom. This is basic. Now, in 1929, you have to search for the easy money. Where was it? And it's easily seen what happened in 1924, 1925. There was the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System was brand new, had come into existence in 1914. Right at the beginning, it became an instrument for war financing, easy money, providing easy money for the U.S. Treasury. 1916, 1917, 1918, 1919, it became just a tool for wartime financing. Of World War One, American participation. Now, and then finally, you know, when everything was boiling and the Federal Reserve then finally decided to cut it out, then in 1920 there was the depression. But what happened? By 1924 there were two factors that made the Federal Reserve step on the accelerator again. One was, there were symptoms of stagnation and recession. And therefore, the Federal Reserve decided to stimulate a little. This was the first time in the history of the Federal Reserve, this new central bank that had come into existence in 1914. This was the first time that the Federal Reserve now stepped on the accelerator in order to stimulate. It expanded money. It flooded the money markets with some $500 million of easy money in order to stimulate. That was one motive. And then there was another one during the 1920s. There, Great Britain financially was in trouble. The pound sterling had been inflated during World War One, was very weak, and the British had a hard time with inflation, and they were losing gold fast. Pound sterling was under pressure during the 1920s. Moreover, there was the attempt on the part of the British government now really to return the pound sterling, get it back to 1914 purchasing power. That means actually they tried to deflate in order to get back the pound sterling back to 1914. At any rate, the British were always urging the Federal Reserve System to inflate a little, take it easy. You know, the easier the dollar was, the better it was for the pound sterling that was under pressure. Therefore, the British were always here urging easy monetary policies. And the Federal Reserve tried to oblige. It did so in 1924, 25, and later on there was another binge in 1927. Once again, in order to stimulate a little and in order to help the British. The pound sterling was under pressure. And thus they flooded the money markets. As a result, there were two fevers. Well, the fever was visible in two fields. One, in real estate, If you look at the real estate market during the 1920s, there was a tremendous fever there. Real estate prices soared, and there was feverish activity. And secondly, there was feverish activity in the stock market. The stock market took off. Every day the stock market became very popular, and the stock market was boiling, and by 19, every day a new high, and the masses of the people participated, you know, became a popular activity, a gambling, it was gambling mentality in the stock market. The inflation there, this injection of easy money, was not so severe that it began to affect consumer prices. Consumer prices did not go up. As a matter of fact, if you use inflation in the terminology of price inflation, look at prices and look at consumer prices, you don't see any inflation during the 1920s. That's why the Chicago School and the Keynesian schools always deny this, what I'm saying here. I'm talking about easy money, and I'm pointing at the printing presses. I can give figures, Federal Reserve figures, what the Federal Reserve has done, but consumer prices were rather steady during the 1920s. There was still rising productivity and output, and the inflation, the injection of money, was not so severe that it actually lifted consumer prices. It did not do so. But it lifted real estate prices significantly and stock prices. There was fever in the stock market. Finally, there was so much fever in the stock market, you know, that by 1928, then finally the Federal Reserve decided to stop it. No, this could not go on. And then when you have feverish financial markets, in times of the gold standard, then gold tends to leave the country because of this easy money and the anticipation of rising prices. Gold can buy more somewhere else, and therefore it tended to leave. And therefore, in 1928, finally the Federal Reserve stopped, it got off the accelerator. In fact, you may say it got on the brake. It lifted the discount rate. The discount rate is the official rate which the Federal Reserve is charging, to 6%, which was an all-time high, and in New York, even to 7%. This was a very high interest rate. That means it stepped on the brakes. And as a result thereof, the boom came to an end, a recession began. As a matter of fact, the early indicators of a recession were already visible by May and June of 1929. When you look at steel prices, steel scrap prices, and other commodity prices, they were beginning to head south. Finally, in September, and especially in October, then the masses of the people in the stock market caught on, which then led to a crash. A crash, by the way, beginning on October 24th, there was, you know, a crash is a phenomenon where the masses of the people try to catch up with the new trend, downtrend of the market. The downtrend had begun already. And by the way, I've studied the stock in this crash in all detail. You'll find I think there's some discussion of this in my article in the Conservative Digest in the July issue. My point is this here. Now that the top of the market, I think, was reached in August of 1929, and then at first there was very feverish activity, huge volume. September stock market volume was the biggest ever. No, the stock market battles took place, you know, every day. The bulls and the bears, was feverish activity and huge volume. Finally, then a break 6 weeks later, after the top had been reached. The top of the market was on August 30th, I think. On October 24, which is about 7 weeks later, then finally the crash took place. And the crash is usually a phenomenon when the masses of the people try to become aware of a new trend, downtrend, and try to catch up. And they too want to sell finally. And then a crash began. As a matter of fact, there were a number of crashes from October 24 until November 12. But the stock market lost about half of its value. That's a crash. That's the crash of 1929. I expect sooner or later something. Today, by the way, I think that sooner or later we'll see a similar phenomenon. Now, and that's why I studied the 1929 crash in all detail. Now, and I would expect also a 50% drop in short order. But it would take here from October 24 until November 12th. Now, that was 3 weeks of continuous falls until the stock market had lost 50% of its value. And that came about 7 weeks after the top had been reached, the high of the market had been reached. And the 7 weeks preceding a crash are weeks of feverish volume. You know, you expect new record volumes every day. 200 million shares traded, 300 million shares traded, very feverish, and then the crash, you know. And this is how it happened, what happened in 1929. Well, and then after the crash was the readjustment. Readjustment is a managerial task. Businessmen have to readjust. They have to get their house in order. They have to eliminate bad projects. They have to write off bad investments. They have to correct their production. They have to get their costs under control. Cut costs, until finally they become profitable again. So that takes a while. That may take a year or two or three at the most. And then after the readjustment has taken place, the bad projects have been written off, the bad investors have been liquidated, have gone into bankruptcy, the worst corporations that made the most mistakes during the economic boom, they go into bankruptcy, and then finally after a while, when all the mistakes have been corrected, then the economy picks up again. It takes at the most 3 years. But therefore, I call this the first phase of the Great Depression. Now, 1924. Here we begin in 1924 to 1929. And then the decline, let's say, of 1930-31. I ascribe to this financial phenomenon, this maladjustment. Let's call this monetary or financial, the financial phase of the Great Depression. But I cannot explain the depression of 1939, 1940, or 41 by pointing at the Coolidge financial policies of 1924. No, the fact is here, it got worse. Normally, the readjustment is over. Business becomes profitable again. What happened here? I need a new explanation here. This year, the crash of 1930, 1931, you can explain with the Coolidge policies of 24, 25, and 27, and 28. You know, the easy money, the fever in the stock market, the fever in real estate. That's it. But what happened next, I cannot put on Coolidge of 1924. What happened here? Actually, there's a new set of causes, set. What happened? Now, the Republicans are in control in the White House and the Congress. They always had a ready answer to all economic ailments. Protectionism. Let's close the borders. In 1930, the recession had just begun. By the way, the average unemployment in 1930 was only 4 million. No disaster as yet.
Out of how many million? No,
some 4 million in 1930. Now, I can give you the percentage. the percentage was about 8% unemployment by that time. Now figure it out, you know. It was not a disaster as yet, you know. But then the Congress had to act, you know, the Republicans decided to do something about it, you know, and President Hoover in the White House, and they decided to close the borders. That's the old recipe of the Republican Party, you know. Now I could talk about the Republican Party, the history and tradition and the values of the Republican Party, but let it suffice here that in 1930, you know, they passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, you know. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which was the imposing the highest tariff in American history. As a matter of fact, you know, the average rate was raised to about 55% tax on all foreign products, the average, you know, 55%, practically closing all borders. Well, they never learned a basic economic lesson. If you eliminate imports and deny foreigners the ability to earn some money, earn American dollars, then they cannot buy. If you eliminate imports, you also eliminate exports. Trade is a two-way street. And therefore, the moment the American industrialists in 1930, they're usually the ones in the industrialists pushing for restrictions on imports. The moment they were successful and the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was passed, immediately, with the borders being closed, foreign trade was grinding to a halt. Immediately, not just the imports came to an end, but also exports. What's the biggest and most important American export industry even today? Agriculture. Agriculture used to export about 50% of its crops, of its output, to Europe, to European markets. 50% of the wheat, 50% of the cotton, or lesser percentage of corn. Now, and so American agriculture depends entirely, and even today, depends entirely on exports. On any measure that impedes trade immediately hurts the American farmers. By 1931 and 1932, after the borders had been closed, there was utter depression in American agriculture. Even the most able farmer in 1932 couldn't make ends meet. As a matter of fact, you know, the farm prices dropped to such lows, hundreds of thousands of farmers just walked off their farms. They couldn't make it. Tens of thousands lost their farms, and many were sold at the minimum price, which was $50. That's the fee the sheriffs used to charge, $50. Today they charge, I think, $150 or so for any such action. Now, thousands of farms were sold at the auction for $50. As a matter of fact, you know, I have two little spreads in Pennsylvania. No, and then I have neighbors. Some of these neighbors are rather affluent. They own a square mile. One owns probably 2,000 acres, and the other one 1,000 acres. They all got their farms, picking them up in 1931, 1932 for $50 a farm here, $100 a farm there. They created, or not the present farmers, their parents, their fathers before them, had assembled the modern spreads, the spreads of today, the square mile or the 2 square miles today, having bought the farms for $50 each. Now, there was utter despair in rural America. And with the failure of the farmers, immediately there came the failure of the farm banks, the rural banks. By the thousands they failed, holding the mortgages on the farms, holding the mortgages or the chattel mortgages on the mules, on the cattle, and so on. Now, and they failed. Banks began to fail by the thousands. I have a rough figure in my head. Now, it's this. At the beginning of the 20s, there were roughly 30,000 banks, 30,000. 1,000 banks in the United States. By 1933, only 15,000 banks had survived. 15,000 banks. You know, in this decade, the 20s, you know, and up to 1933, half the banks in the United States perished, especially rural banks. I'm not saying this happened all in 1931 and 1932 during the depths of depression, but thousands of rural banks failed at that time. And with the failure of the rural banks, many people who had their savings in the banks, many businesses that had their savings in the banks, they failed when the banks failed that held their money. There was utter despair in the United States. By 1932, unemployment rose to more than 12 million, or a total of some more than 25% of the workers in the United States were unemployed. And another 25% were underemployed. They did not work 40 hours a week. That was the depression after the borders had been closed. But this wasn't all. The Republicans are still in the White House and in the Congress. Now, and then they had another basic policy. Now, the policy of always you should pay your liabilities, you should pay your debts. In 1932, in the midst of depression, the Republican Congress doubled the income tax and raised many other taxes in 1932. Thereafter, nothing would work anymore, and the people were counting the days to election time when they could vote for the opposition. And they did so with a landslide. FDR, the Democrat, in November of 1932, won with a landslide, by a landslide, and kicking out the Republicans. And for 20 years thereafter, to be a Republican was a dirty word. You know? Now, this was the what I call the second phase. But let me add a few additional thoughts here. Now, Hoover at that time being in the White House, you know, and he signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Bill, the act. And he made the announcement that he would sign. I think the announcement came on a Sunday, was in the Sunday press, that on Monday he would sign. You know what? When he made a famous statement, signing the bill, he said, "Prosperity is around the corner." On the day he signed this bill, the stock market broke 20 points, which is like 200 points today or 300 points today. The stock market crashed. Not, you know, the stock market anticipated the depression, not the politicians, not the White House. You know, the White House was signing the bill, and there was a crash on the day he signed. You know? And the Republicans were under the influence of new economics. The new economics was teaching that in depression, it's time to expand, to spend more money. In all other depressions, before that time, whenever there was a depression, revenue declined, government revenue declined, and government cut spending, living within its revenue, its income. Not this time. The Hoover administration was preaching and teaching. As a matter of fact, Hoover sent telegrams to all governors and said, "This is not the time to cut spending, spend more." And he urged corporations. He had called in the business leaders in 1930, called in the business leaders to Washington and said, "Don't cut spending. This is the time to expand." Many railroads did. Many railroads even declared dividends for a year in advance in order to stimulate spending. This new approach, new economics. Within a year or two, they were all bankrupt. You know. At any rate, and then I should add too, this was not just an American policy. This was worldwide. You know, this closing borders, disintegration of the world economy, rampant economic nationalism. That's the time, 1930-31. The British, for instance, called an Empire Trade Conference to Ottawa in 1931, at which time they introduced the Empire Trade Preference System. That means they closed their borders towards the rest of the world, but gave each other breaks, preference to each other. The members of the Commonwealth would be trading with each other only. The British, the Commonwealth, you know, closing borders. France did the same, Germany did the same, they all did the same, and they all suffered the same consequences as a result of this extreme economic nationalism that cut, that closed borders everywhere. The industrial nations, all industrial nations, suffered a depression. And the raw material nations in Latin America and Africa, too, suffered severely when world trade was grinding to a halt. It became a worldwide depression. Not just an American depression. They all did it. It's in vain, I think, to discuss who did it first, who set the example. They all did it. They all closed their borders when the going got rough, and they all suffered the same consequences. Now, here in the United States, by 1932, there was an unemployment of some 25%. In Germany, under similar conditions of world trading, depending on trading, even more so than the United States, there was an unemployment of 30%. You know? They all suffered from unemployment as a result of the disintegration of world cooperation and world trade and world commerce. I'd like to call it, not here by the Smoot-Hawley Act, but it's the phase of the disintegration of the world exchange, of world trade, of world division of labor, of world division of labor. No, world cooperation. In other words, the depression continues. It continued to fall. Once again, I need a new explanation for 1932, 1933. I cannot say, well, Coolidge did it in 1924, or the Coolidge Fed did it in 1924. That won't do. No, because that adjustment took place probably in 1930, 1931. But I need an explanation here for the surprising new decline. The depth of the depression of 1931, 1932. My explanation is the disintegration of world trade, and which was stopped by doubling the income tax by the Hoover administration. Now, to be more specific, now for instance, the top rate of income tax, which used to be at 24%, now in the Republicans raised in 1932 to 64%. You know. In other words, the top income brackets were even raised more than doubled. You know. And thereafter, by the way, FDR later raised the top rate to 75%, 85%. And during the war, the top rate of income tax in the United States was 94%. And after the war, again, this time under President Eisenhower, after the war, now, under President Eisenhower, many tax rates were lowered, but the Republicans kept the top rate at 91%. For 91%. Until President Kennedy came along. It took President Kennedy in the early 60s, I think, in 1962, 63, when the top rate of 91% was finally lowered to 77%, and later to 70%, and then finally the labor income to 50%. Now, and finally, it was only under President Reagan that finally all income taxes were lowered to the top rate to 50%. You know, all rates, not just earned income, but also capital income was lowered to 50%. You know. At any rate, you know, this was the second phase, the phase of the disintegration of the world economy. Then finally, FDR comes to power. You know, he's elected by landslide. The Republicans are washed up, leaving office in the depths of depression. FDR takes over. FDR had two choices. Either he could have repealed all the Republican measures. As a matter of fact, in the platform of 1932, you find that they promised to repeal all this, to repeal the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, lower the taxes again. It's an excellent free enterprise program, 1932. The Democratic Roosevelt program of 1932, very good. The best economists of the time helped to shape it in 1932. But when he came to power, he did something else. He did not repeal the Republican measures, he added his own. He too wanted to be a backseat driver. He too then had a bag of paraphernalia and he wanted to apply his own tricks. And immediately in 1933, now in the depth of depression, 25% of the people unemployed. And what do the Democrats do? Roosevelt? Well, immediately there were three measures, revival measures. He recommended to the Congress, of course, eating out of his hand. Now, immediately adopted the revival measures. The first one was the National Industrial Recovery Act. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, which the Democrats passed, you know. And this was something new. It was based on the notion that there was too much production, too much competition. And therefore, there should be a reduction in output, and therefore, it's too much competition, cutthroat competition. Let's reduce this competition. Let industries get together, form industrial councils, each industry by itself, with industrial self-government, establish industrial cartels, each one by itself, that will self-govern, determine the conditions of production, the costs of production, and so on, and eliminate this fierce cutthroat competition. In other words, eliminate competition, establish industrial councils, and these industrial councils then were to establish industrial codes, establish industrial codes of conduct or what had to be done. For the first time, minimum wages were cranked in. They had to agree on minimum wages. Labor unions had their input there in the industrial codes. As a matter of fact, in many industries, the new codes managed to raise business costs by some 50-55%. As a result of these codes raising costs, as a matter of fact, the conditions got worse. Unemployment continued to rise. As a matter of fact, average unemployment 1 year after the Democrats had taken over had risen from 25% to 6%, now exceeded 13 million. Conditions, the depression continued to deepen. And this was not all. You know, the National Industrial Recovery trying to eliminate competition, saying there's too much competition, too much production here. Let's take it easy and get together and raise costs, so which then takes the pressure off and eliminate competition. And then finally the same Congress, Democratic Congress under Roosevelt, then said, well, we have to do something for agriculture. Agriculture is deeply depressed. So they passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act, AAA, Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, also based on the notion that too much output, we have to reduce output, we have to slow down. Therefore, the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933 provided, it imposed a new tax, the processing tax, and used the money to destroy the crops. In 1934, 1935, the Department of Agriculture was preoccupied with destroying the crops. It was a time when the cotton fields were plowed under in the south, when livestock was destroyed, little pigs were killed, destroyed by the millions. My wife, I don't see her, you could ask her. She grew up on a Pennsylvania farm. She remembers, oh, the potato crops were destroyed. The potatoes were put on huge piles and kerosene was poured over the potato piles. You know, the government was preoccupied with destroying the crops. Now, that was the second measure. There was a third one, a revival measure. And the third one was the government said, well, you know, we have to do something here, and we have to revive exports. And to revive exports, let's devalue the dollar, and let's make it cheaper here for foreigners to buy. That's this way. If we devalue the dollar, then the foreigners can buy more, and that will revive the demand, foreign demand for our products. And therefore, in preparation for a dollar devaluation, FDR confiscated all money, all gold. Gold had to be turned over, had to turned in. Anyone who kept money at home, gold money at home, that became a crime, I think 10 years in jail or something like that, you know. Worse than robbery or manslaughter or rape was to keep a gold coin in your house, you know. In other words, they all had to turn in their money in 1933. As a result of all these three measures, conditions got worse every day. As I mentioned already, unemployment rose to more than 13 million by 1933. But then something happened, as always, I think. There came relief from unexpected quarters. In the moment of darkness and despair, there came relief. Now, relief which no one had expected. And the relief came from the Supreme Court. There were 9 old men on the bench who couldn't believe it. They struck this down. And elimination of competition is unconstitutional. They struck in 1935, they struck this down as unconstitutional, destroying the crops in the field and so as unconstitutional. Unfortunately, they let the dollar devaluation and confiscation of money pass on grounds, and they, by the way, They passed it with a 5-4 vote, and the next day the fifth vote wanted to change, but the fifth justice had changed his mind, but it was too late, and it passed, unfortunately. And it passed on grounds that the court said, where's the damage? They all got paid in paper money. The paper money is worth as much as the gold, and therefore there's no harm inflicted by taking gold and replacing it with pay, show the loss, you know. And however, to foreigners, surely the devaluation meant a loss. Anyone who had American money here, a foreigner, and trying to keep it, to get it back, change it into his native currency, surely would have lost 40%. In 1934, there was the devaluation of 40%. Now, at first, the government seized the gold, and having seized the gold, then it devalued the paper money. That means it boosted the price of gold from $20.67 to $35 an ounce. You know? Or in other words, the American dollar, which used to be worth 1/20th 67th, was reduced to 1/35th of an ounce of gold. That's a 40% reduction in the gold content of the American dollar. Foreigners who had money here surely would lose. Therefore, the Supreme Court provided that for half a year, foreigners could sue for damages. For half a year. In the half a year, no foreigner sued for damage. So it passed, so it became constitutional that the money could be seized and that the American dollar could be devalued. I think that was an unfortunate mistake the Supreme Court made. Even if at that time no damage was visible, but in the long run, surely, look at the American dollar today, which is worth less than 1/10th of 1933. At any rate, that's the third phase, the phase of NRA and AAA, no further decline, but then After a while, then a slight recovery after the Supreme Court voided all these Democratic New Deal laws. Then what happened? Well, there was a slight recovery. Unemployment by 1936, at the beginning of 1937, now declined to some 7.5 million. That's still a very high rate of unemployment, but to about 7.5 million. But then what happened? Suddenly in the fall of 1937, They developed a depression in a depression. The American economy collapsed again in just 8 months. In shortest time on record in American history, the American economy collapsed again and unemployment rose to more than 11 million during the winter of 37-38 here. A new collapse, and then in the years thereafter, 38, 39, 40, 41, unemployment remained at depression levels, 9.5 million, until the day of Pearl Harbor. What happened? What happened here? I have to explain, and once again, I need an explanation. I cannot say, well, Coolidge did it in 1924, or I cannot say, it was the disintegration of the world economy. No, that, the adjustment, the depression had taken place. Or I cannot even put it on NRA or AAA of 1933, that suddenly in the fall of 1937, there was a collapse of the American economy. I have to search for new answers. What are the answers? Well, I would like to give a few there. On the file, I give a few first. Minor ones, and then I give the most important one last. In 1936 was election time, so at that time there was a kind of recovery. Unemployment was declining, not because of FDR, but because of the Supreme Court having thrown out all these worst laws, having voided, declared unconstitutional the early Democratic New Deal. Therefore, there were a number of measures. One was in 1936-1937. Now, the 1937, FDR was striking back. He was upset that his efforts, the early New Deal, was declared unconstitutional by 9 old men. Now, and therefore he tried to do something about it. He had complete control over the administration. He had utter control over the Democratic Congress. Now he wanted to change the Supreme Court. He proposed to pack the Supreme Court with 9 additional, several of his additional friends, who then would change the composition of the Supreme Court and remove the obstacle, his obstacle of the Supreme, in the form of the Supreme Court. In other words, there was the famous Supreme Court packing fight of 1937. Now, that's the first fight he lost. His own party turned against him. There were dictators in Europe. There was Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco. And now FDR, who had control over the administration, control over the Congress, now wanted control over the Supreme Court. The American people were not ready for that. And therefore, his own party turned against him when he wanted to pack the Supreme Court with his friends. But it shocked the nation and contributed to this new break. Now, the depression, in the depression, 1937 break, when in very short time, in the shortest time in history, the American economy collapsed again. Here, it had taken 2 years for depression really to develop. In 1937, it took 8 months, and there were 11 million unemployed. There were other measures. There was a new tax, the undistributed profit tax. He proposed to take away all the money left in the private corporations, the undistributed profits. Ford and others had some money left. The family corporation had some money left. He proposed not just to take profits, to take anything left in the government, some 80% of capital, undistributed profits, capital, liquid capital in the corporation, so that government would spend it. The idea was we need spending, and therefore government was after this money in the corporations. But that led to a very ugly fight. It shocked the business community. The business community fought hard. When it finally passed, the undistributed profit tax, it was passed at a very lower level, and was past the 25% instead of 80 and 85% what he wanted to take, you know. So the danger was averted, but it was quite a danger for a while, you know. By the way, the tax is still with us today, you know, the undistributed profit tax is still with us, it's still on the books. If you are a businessman and you plow back some money, and then there is a tax which will take some of the money you retain in the corporations. There's a limit to what you can retain. You must pay out and be taxed. Otherwise, this undistributed profit tax will get you, even today, you know.